back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, as always. We are talking about Ayatollah Khamenei's views or fatwas issued regarding Ramadan and fasting. Since we are, in fact, near the end of the month of Ramadan, so we saw it fit and we deemed it suitable to talk about some of the laws which are somehow pertinent and related to the end of this blessed month. Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question at the beginning of this episode. A person was fasting here in Iran, in fact, on the 20th of Ramadan, right? And he traveled to another country, a neighboring country, such as, for example, the UAE. And there, in the UAE, the government declares this is the first of Sha'wal, the beginning of Shawwal, which is the next month after Ramadan.
Sure.
And it's a governmental issue or declaration. So how should he go about it?
Well, I should say that some Sunni countries, declare the Eid day one day usually before the Shia countries. And according to Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, it is necessary to make sure that the moon has been sighted, the crescent of the month of Shawwal has been sighted. Otherwise, the beginning of the next month is not ascertained, it's not established. And of course, mu'mineen, the followers of Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, can check with his official website and see whether the beginning of the month of Ramadan has been announced or not. As long as they are not certain, they should not break their fast, no matter what the government might, have announced, on their official channels or through their radio or TV channels, And so everyone has to follow his own mujtahid's fatwa. Now, according to Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, the beginning of the moon is established by using, anything which is possible, which can be used to sight the moon, And it can be established by, watching, by seeing the moon using binoculars, telescopes, and anything like that. And, the Shia authorities, the Shia religious authorities, differ in their opinion when it comes to us.
I will ask you some separate questions regarding that, obviously, later on.
That's for sure. Yeah, that's important, Sunni Muslim countries also have a lot of problems. We see that in the month of Ramadan, let's say Pakistan, they have a halal committee, And in that committee, there are Sunni scholars and Shia scholars. They sit together and they try to cite the crescent. And of course, we see that Pakistan declares announces the Eid day even one day after some other countries, 2 days after some other countries. Mm-hmm. While Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, they sometimes declare announce the Eid day 2 days before Pakistan. So Iran is in the middle, Iran Iran has its own standards to... based on the fatwa of Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. So whenever the moon is sighted or when it is established that it is the month of the beginning of the month of Shawwal, so that the Eid day or the month or the beginning of the next month is announced on the official government TV channels or radios.
So this traveler, in fact, should listen to his own mujtahid or religious authority back in Iran, and the changing of the location or geography doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, it doesn't make a difference. Sure.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break. We'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about Ramadan-related jurisprudential laws, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, although we have discussed this question with you in the past, but I would like to explain whether the beginning of the month of Shawwal can be established by seeing the moon through binoculars or telescope. You also had a quick reference before the break about moon sighting.
Yeah, this is a very important question because the Shia Muslims remain somehow, you know, at you know, polarized mm-hmm. when regarding the beginning of the month of Shawwal, because they wish to celebrate the Eid day together with their families. So we can see sometimes that in a single family there are individuals following one marja and the other individuals following another marja. So.
Yes.
Some members of the family fast and others, you know, break their fast and celebrate the Eid. So it becomes quite, you know, difficult for the family.
I see.
And that's why it is because of the different fatwas given by the religious authorities. Of course, every mujtahid has his own principles and foundations based on which he issues his fatwa. And as Grand Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that the beginning of the month of Shawwal or any other month, lunar month, is established by sighting the moon by any means, whatever the means. It could be binoculars or it could be a telescope or anything which may magnify the particles or things in the space which would, you know, enable the individual to sight the moon and find the crescent. So if the crescent is found by using, let's say, a telescope, and if the crescent is found using a telescope, that's okay with Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, and the beginning of the month of Shawwal is established. But, you know, other religious authorities, or maybe some few other religious authorities, have stated that the beginning of the month of Shawwal cannot be established by using binoculars or a telescope. For example, Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that one has to sight the moon with his own naked eyes.
Mm-hmm, I see. Sheikh Javid, we are at the end of our program. Please elaborate for our audience about the amount of fitrah. How much is it, you know, and when is it necessary to pay? Can it be paid in any time during the month of Ramadan or after Eid al-Fitr?
Again, I would like to say that according to some religious authorities, including, for example, Ayatollah Sistani, he's of the view that the Zakat al-Fitr can be given any time during the month of Ramadan. But this
yes.
is not what Ayatollah Khamenei says. He is of the view that the Zakat al-Fitr has to be separated in the morning or in the evening of the Eid day. For example, today is the last day of Ramadan. And so from Maghrib time until the midday of the next day, it is mm-hmm. One has to, you know, separate his Zakat al-Fitr and put it aside. He should make
yes.
sure to give the Zakat al-Fitr as soon as possible to the poor and to the needy.
Mm.
And when it comes to the amount of Zakat al-Fitr, of course, the amount of Zakat al-Fitr is worth 3 kilos of food stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It could be 3 kilos of rice, 3 kilos of noodles. And of course, you can give the money worth 3 kilos of rice, the money worth 3 kilos of bread, or 3 kilos of anything. And depending on mm-hmm. what the staple food is, you have to give it to the needy people. You have to give it as soon as possible.
Okay.
And you should give it to the poor people in your city.
I see.
Not poor people living in a different country.
I see.
As far as possible. But if it's not possible, and if there are no poor people, you can send the money. The money okay. that you have put aside
okay.
to another country.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice contribution to this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Malja ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir La ilaha illahum Rahim محيٍ مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States. Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Israeli-Russian ties have been deteriorating rapidly over the past few weeks. Most recently, Russia's ambassador to Israel, Anatoly Viktorov, has warned that Moscow will introduce retaliatory measures against Israel in case the Tel Aviv regime supplies Ukraine with military equipment and aid amid the military conflict there. Viktorov issued the warning in a televised interview on Thursday. It was not immediately clear from the Russian envoy's remarks what such a response might entail.
And I think that we'll see strengthening of cooperation and increased military support for Syria and other regional partners of Russia in the region if Israel goes along with supporting Ukraine. And it's important to note that Ukraine has said that it wants to be in Israel. It wants to be Israel in Europe. It doesn't want to be absolutely liberal and European.
The comments came a day after the Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Israel will provide Ukraine with helmets and flak jackets. Last week, the Russian Foreign Ministry summoned Israeli ambassador to Moscow after Tel Aviv denounced Russia's military operation in Ukraine. It came after the Israeli Foreign Minister accused Russia of committing war crimes in Ukraine, alleging that there was no justification for Russia's military campaign against its western neighbor. Earlier this month, the Israeli regime voted in favor of a United Nations General Assembly resolution suspending the Russian Federation's membership in the UN Human Rights Council. The move was made over claims of gross and systematic violations and abuses of human rights in Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry called the resolution, quote, unlawful and politically motivated. Taking a sideswipe at Israel and the United States, the Russian Foreign Ministry has said that the longest occupation in the post-war history is being carried out by Israel with the tacit approval of the West. The ministry further bashed the blockade of the besieged Gaza Strip, which Israel says is needed to prevent arms from reaching the Palestinian resistance movements in the enclave.
Well, one of the things that it's important is that Israel saying that Russia has committed war crimes is laughable, since Israel itself has been liable and the charges are severe to their war crimes and human rights violations against the Palestinian people, most recently in the war on the people of Gaza just last year in 2021.
Ukraine has asked Israel for weapons and equipment, including the Iron Dome missile system, something that Tel Aviv hasn't publicly approved so far. Russia has said that foreign weapons sent to Ukraine will be fair game for its military attacks. If Israel decides to sell arms to Russia's western neighbor, will there be a conflict between the two?
So I think it's not yet sure what's happening, but I think what we are seeing is a shift of Israel from being neutral in this current special military operation to openly supporting Ukraine. So it might shift, but it will cost them. It'll cost them heavily because Russia is an important player in Israel-Palestine.
Since Russian President Vladimir Putin announced a special military operation in Ukraine on February 24 and officially recognized the breakaway regions of Luhansk and Donetsk as two republics, the political lines across the globe have been getting redrawn. As Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned, that risks the situation spiraling into a third world war.
In a recent report by the New York Times, Canada's main city of Toronto was described as the Wild West of marijuana shops. According to the report, Ontario's provincial government permitted the shops by emergency order to keep operating during the COVID-19 pandemic, even during lockdowns. During this period, to the investors' delight, shares in the stocks of licensed medical marijuana growers in Canada have multiplied in price. However, the marijuana business was already expected to flourish, even before the pandemic started in 2019 and right after Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, to fulfill a campaign promise, introduced legislation to legalize the recreational use of marijuana in Canada, the prospects look good. Eventually, the Government of Canada legalized cannabis for recreational use on October 17, 2018. The Cannabis Act creates a legal and regulatory framework for controlling the production, distribution, sale and possession of cannabis in Canada. Canada is now the second nation after Uruguay to completely legalize marijuana as a consumer product in an effort to extinguish the criminal trade and keep the substance out of the hands of youth by regulating the market. However, growing, importing, exporting, or selling marijuana, particularly to minors, outside licensed channels, remain a serious crime. Meanwhile, critics of the cannabis law highlight the damaging impact to society of the widespread use of the drugs. When the use of cannabis becomes more widespread, the drug can also have downsides, including acute injuries and illnesses. In some cases, marijuana could lead to cyclical vomiting syndrome, a condition characterized by vomiting and severe abdominal pain. And also, those who use cannabis are more prone to mental illnesses. While many shops remain closed in Toronto, following several rounds of lockdowns and many office towers in the city remain mostly empty, the marijuana shops apparently have a booming business. They were permitted by the provincial government's emergency order to keep operating during the pandemic. In March 2020, during the early months of the pandemic, there were only 12 cannabis shops, but now there are 430 shops with another 88 in the approval process. When Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government legalized marijuana in 2018, its primary goal was to create a more equitable justice system by putting an end to heavily racialized arrests, possession, not a major new business sector. According to a recent government-sponsored report, in only 3 years, sales of legal marijuana in Ontario have outpaced estimates of unlicensed sales and boosted the economy by $10.6 billion. Polls indicate that more Canadians consume it than they did before, 25% of people 16 and up. Violence at the Al-Aqsa compound has surged during the fasting month of Ramadan. It all began when dozens of Israeli military forces stormed into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Old City of Al-Quds and restricted the entry of Palestinian worshippers into the Flashpoint holy site to secure the incursion of hundreds of extremist settlers to mark the Passover holiday. Regime forces assaulted Muslim worshippers inside prayer halls while protecting the Israeli settlers desecrating Islam's third holiest site. So far, at least 19 Palestinians have been killed, while hundreds more have been injured in clashes with Israeli forces. This has raised concerns about a slide back into the wider Israeli-Palestinian conflict, like the one in May last year when frequent acts of violence against Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque led to an 11-day war between Palestinian resistance groups in the besieged Gaza Strip and the Israeli regime. But why is the Al-Aqsa compound a central point of contention in the issue of Palestine? Israel-occupied East Al-Quds, where Al-Aqsa is located, during the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. It annexed the entire city in 1980 in a move never recognized by the international community. The illegal Israeli control of East Al-Quds, including the Old City, violates several principles of international law, which outlines that an occupying power does not have sovereignty in the territory it occupies. Following Israel's occupation of East Al-Quds, a delegated status quo was agreed upon, with Jordan giving Muslims the sole right to pray at Al-Aqsa and Jews at the nearby Western Wall. However, Palestinians accuse Israel of restricting Muslim worship at Al-Aqsa while not doing enough to enforce the ban on Jewish prayer at the compound and even protecting the violators. The ensuing Israeli aggression against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa compound is a flagrant violation of the status quo. Next, what has the international community done to put an end to Israeli violence against Palestinians? Well, the regime in Tel Aviv continues its crimes with total impunity, and the international community is silent, except for a few words of caution. The United Nations believes it suffices to express deep concern over the worsening security situation in the occupied Palestinian territories, saying it will probe into the use of force at Al-Aqsa. But is that enough? Perhaps the world's largest and most familiar international organization is too busy, preoccupied, or distracted with the Russia-Ukraine war, but the issue of Palestine deserves the same, if not more, attention since it has been ongoing for several decades. Thousands of people across the globe have taken to the streets to deplore Israeli violence against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and elsewhere in the occupied territories, as the regime in Tel Aviv continues its crimes in Palestine. In Pakistan, thousands of people took part in rallies after Friday prayers in major cities, denouncing the Israeli attacks on Palestinian worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque as naked terrorism and urging Islamic countries to intervene immediately to protect the sacred site and Palestinian lives. Also in Bangladesh, thousands of people demonstrated against the Israeli onslaught. Elsewhere in Jordan, the protesters called for the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador and Amman's withdrawal from the Jordan-Israeli peace treaty signed in 1994. Pro-Palestinian rallies, however, have not been limited to Muslim-majority countries. Rallies were held in the US as well as European capitals such as Amsterdam, London, and Berlin. The protesters called for international action, including sanctions to end the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories and the regime's growing aggression.
And so we're on a continuous upward trend, a continuous upward surge in support for Palestine and support for the boycott and isolation of the Israeli occupation and in standing with the Palestinian resistance.
More protests have been organized in other countries worldwide. One of the many online websites promoting resistance against Israel is Samidun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, which has urged all Palestinian, Arab, and international supporters of Palestine to organize events and confront Israeli massacres and ethnic cleansing, events which are held by different organizations around the world.
Israeli military forces have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds as worshippers gathered for dawn prayers, with medics reporting that more than 40 Palestinians were injured as a result of the raid. Local sources said some worshippers were trapped inside the mosque amid clouds of tear gas, with the regime troops throwing stun grenades at them. According to the Palestinian media, at least 43 Palestinians were injured in the raid. The development comes a day after as many as 30 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli forces continued their violent attacks against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds. The troops used rubber bullets, tear gas canisters, stun grenades, and pepper spray against the worshippers, who have been braving increasing aggression ordered by the Israeli regime since the beginning of the holy fasting month of Ramadan.
Right now, the site of the mosque is sacred to three major religions, but the Israelis have no consideration for anyone but themselves and their own wants and desires. So right now, when they are entering the mosque, the sacred mosque, attacking people while they're praying, worshippers are there for dawn prayers, and the IDF soldiers and the settlers are simply invading the mosque, firing tear gas, rubber bullets, and live rounds of ammunition sometimes, all to terrorize and drive them away because they want the site completely for themselves.
The series of raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, one of the holiest sites in Islam, began last Saturday when the Israeli troops injured more than 150 Palestinians there. Israel's new campaign against the Palestinians doesn't stop at the occupied West Bank. On Thursday, the Israeli army carried out airstrikes across the Gaza Strip, targeting positions belonging to the resistance groups. Similar developments last year led to an 11-day war between Israel and Gaza-based resistance groups. The conflict killed over 260 Palestinians, including scores of women and children. The Arab League broke its silence on the Israeli raid on Al-Aqsa, calling on the regime to prevent Israelis from entering the compound. In an emergency meeting in the Jordanian capital, Amman, the organization warned that Israel's actions threaten to ignite a cycle of violence, and the attacks and violations represent a blatant provocation to the feelings of Muslims. But how will such declarations help defuse the situation when, ironically, countries that have recently normalized their ties with Israel, including the United Arab Emirates and Morocco, were in attendance at the meeting? People took to the streets of the Jordanian capital, Amman, in solidarity with the Palestinians on Friday, calling on the government to expel the Israeli ambassador and scrap a peace treaty signed with the regime. Such protests have been held in several different countries, but without a unified international response to Israel, the protests are unlikely to be enough to put an end to such violations.
The international community, as you mentioned, is not doing anything about this. It's so hypocritical to see the international community condemn the things that the Russians are doing to the Ukrainians when the Israelis are doing the exact same things to the Palestinians, and that and their crimes are supported by the United States and other nations.
In the absence of any practical measure taken against the regime, resistance seems to be the only option.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qomi. Stay tuned.
عزیزان گاهی اگر ما قدر یه نعمت رو ندونیم خوب ازش استفاده نمی‌کنیم.
Dear brothers and sisters, sometimes we are not grateful enough to the blessing of Allah. We become thankful if we are grateful in facing the blessing of Allah. Sheikh As-Saduq narrates a hadith from one of the companions of Prophet Muhammad stating, once when Prophet was among his companions and he in a strange mood repeated Subhanallah 3 times and then said, do you know what is coming to you?
Mm-hmm.
اصحاب ترسیدن. یک کسی گفت
Upon hearing this repetition of Subhanallah for three times, the companions asked Prophet Muhammad, Are you frightened by what is coming to us, or an ayah is revealed to you? Prophet Muhammad answered, None. The holy month of Allah, the Ramadan, has arrived. This is the main reason for my fascination and strange feeling. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hosseini Qomi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Human values are alien to the Zionist regime. Imam Khomeini. Everybody together, unanimously with one voice, present at the glorious demonstration of God's Day.
In the limelight.
The problems that have recently engulfed the previous favourite to succeed Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak, over his wife's tax affairs and the fact that he too was fined for breaking lockdown rules, are seen as having destroyed his chances of following Boris Johnson into No. 10 Downing Street. We now present you an article written by Toby Helm and Michael Savage. The piece is titled, Top Tory MPs Say Boris Johnson Should Go Sooner Rather Than Later. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Plans to ditch Boris Johnson as Tory leader and UK's Prime Minister sooner rather than later, without waiting for a clear and obvious successor to emerge, are being advanced by a growing number of senior Conservative MPs. Amid mounting alarm at the effects the Partygate scandal could have on their electoral chances, high-ranking MPs are urging wavering colleagues not to dither because of worries about the succession, or Russia's operation in Ukraine, but rather to strike before it's too late. One former minister told The Guardian, Things have changed. There is now a feeling that we can't defend what is going on and we can't delay any longer because of the succession or because of Ukraine. If we don't act well before the party conference in October, it will be too late. after another disastrous week for Boris Johnson, during which MPs of all parties agreed to set up their own investigation into whether he deliberately misled Parliament. MPs say several potential successors are stepping up campaign preparations and canvassing support, including Liz Truss, Penny Mordaunt, and Jeremy Hunt. On Friday night, 22nd of April, Mark Harper, the former Tory chief whip, who recently called for Boris Johnson to go, told The Guardian he understood why some colleagues wanted to delay acting until after Partygate investigations were complete, or for other reasons. But Mark Harper urged them to have confidence that an excellent successor would emerge during the process to elect a new leader, even if it was unclear now who that would be. Mark Harper said, "I have seen enough to reach a conclusion that the Prime Minister needs to go." He claimed, "My colleagues can be confident that we have very talented people and a very robust process for selecting a new leader that will ensure we get a capable, credible successor who can set out an attractive proposition and ensure we can win the next election." He added, "I think the facts will mean that a majority of Conservative MPs will reach the conclusion that the Prime Minister needs to go." He said another former cabinet minister said doubts over the succession were now irrelevant. Such was the urgency of the situation, adding, "A broomstick will be better than what we have at the moment." The mood swung dramatically against Boris Johnson recently after he was forced to apologise to the House of Commons for being fined for attending a lockdown birthday party in 2020, and then appeared to back attempts to order his own MPs to block an investigation into whether he had deliberately misled Parliament by previously denying parties had taken place. Many Conservative MPs are waiting until the results of the 5th of May local elections before deciding whether to send a formal letter of no confidence in Johnson to the chair of the backbench 1922 committee, Sir Graham Brady. If Sir Graham Brady receives 54 or more such letters, a vote of confidence has to be held, and if Boris Johnson loses that vote, he must step down. The problems that have recently engulfed the previous favourite to succeed Johnson, the Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak, over his wife's tax affairs and the fact that he too was fined for breaking lockdown rules, are seen as having destroyed his chances of following Boris Johnson into No. 10 Downing Street. The Tory peer, Lord Hayward, agreed that the mood had changed and succession issues were less likely to hold MPs back. He said, "I get the impression that because people have moved from whatever position they were in to a more sceptical position, they now believe it's just got to happen, and we'll have the conversation about who next when it happens. There are people moving, reaching the point of no return, even though they're not sure who the alternative would be. It's only a question of judging when the moment arrives." Another senior Conservative MP said, "Lots of colleagues who have local elections going on have been hearing, 'I like what you're doing as our new MP, but we can't vote for you while the blithering idiot is in office.' I spoke to several MPs recently who had all taken their seats from Labour. They all said the situation was terrible. They're starting to say it's not whether, but when, and it doesn't matter who, as long as it's not him." Boris Johnson insisted during a two-day trade trip to India that he would lead his party into the next general election. But the Partygate scandal dogged him throughout the visit to India, Shortly before his return to London on Friday, 22nd of April, it emerged that the Metropolitan Police had started to issue fines for another party that he attended, in this case, a garden event on 20th of May 2020. Number 10 Downing Street said Johnson had not been fined for attending the event, though it was impossible to say whether he would be in the future. Opposition party leaders said it would be unacceptable for the Prime Minister to hold back information about whether he had been fined ahead of local elections. Labour's deputy leader Angela Rayner said there can be no hiding place for law-breaking, and that includes in Downing Street. Boris Johnson must keep the promise and declare without hesitation if he is given another fine for breaking his own lockdown laws. He has withheld the truth from the British public for far too long. A cabinet source also predicted the local elections on 5th of May could be as dire for the Conservatives as the 2019 European Parliament elections, where the party won their lowest ever share of the vote. Ian Duncan Smith, a former Tory party leader, said many MPs had not grown any more hostile to Johnson because of the poor handling of the vote about the Prime Minister being investigated for misleading Parliament. However, he told The Guardian, "We'll wait to see what happens at the end of this. The majority of the public are sick and tired of the story. Conservative MPs are sick and tired of the story as well." He said colleagues may decide if it is recoverable. If they reach the decision it's too damaging, then it's over. That balance is just sitting, waiting. I fancy that the local elections and inquiry will put that to rest. Steve Brine, a former health minister, was also revealed to have told a constituent that a confidence vote in Boris Johnson should take place sooner rather than later. Steve Brine emailed, "This is not a sustainable situation, and I suspect further fixed penalty notices will follow those issued recently. I will be liaising with senior colleagues to see that the confidence is tested in the period ahead." Robert Largan, the new Tory MP for High Peak in Derbyshire, the 14th most marginal seat in the country, also told constituents he would not defend the indefensible. He said, "We cannot have a situation where it is one rule for politicians and another rule for everyone else. I can assure you that I am taking the appropriate action to defend integrity in public life." Rory Stewart, a former cabinet minister, also predicted the May elections would demonstrate Boris Johnson has lost his magic and the Conservative MPs will then conclude there is no point staying behind him. Conservative MPs who have submitted letters of no confidence in Boris Johnson felt quietly optimistic that others would follow suit and we'd be given heart by the likes of senior backbenchers Mark Harper and Steve Baker, calling on the Prime Minister to go in the coming days. One surmised, "They'll just do it quietly or privately, until we're left with these mad people who wouldn't get anything under another regime." Another MP supportive of Boris Johnson admitted, "It's so unpredictable and all seems to have changed again. I've gone from thinking he should be safe to thinking this is it." A Conservative MP who previously kept an open mind about Boris Johnson's future diagnosed the concerns about his political leadership as terminal. Winding up his two-day trip to India, an exasperated Boris Johnson was unable to escape fresh questions about the Partygate row. He was adamant he would still be Prime Minister in October when he hopes a free trade deal with India could be ready to sign, and insisted he was in India to discuss issues of interest to British voters. Going on to highlight cooperation with the Indian government on green energy and defence, he said, "I think what people want in our country is for the government to get on and focus on the issues on which we were elected, and that's what we're going to do. And I think they'll be particularly interested in jobs and economic growth in the UK. In an odd outburst, responding to a question about whether he would compare himself to a cat with nine lives, Boris Johnson said, "We had a pretty good kick of the cat yesterday," but quickly added, "Not that I'm in favour of kicking cats."
Another Ramadan, another attack on Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, a harsh reminder of the Israeli occupation of this holy land. Built on a foundation of colonial apartheid, the Israeli regime has shown since its inception that peace is the last thing it cares about. Arresting children, firing tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets at Muslim worshippers, assaulting medical staff and journalists, bombing residential areas, the list goes on and on. All these acts of violence has one message in common. The fate of the Palestinian nation is at the whim of an aggressive regime in the land it has occupied illegally for decades. The possibility of a lasting peace deal seems as far away as ever, and the history of failed negotiations indicates it's basically because Israel prefers the status quo. In fact, Israel has drastically moved away from even the aspiration to make peace. The revealing item of evidence of Israel's rejection of peace is the settlements project. If the regime had really wanted to achieve peace via the Oslo Accords, it would at least have stopped the settlements project at its own initiative. By the same token, the direct negotiations between Mahmoud Abbas and Benjamin Netanyahu in 2010 could have lasted more than 13 days if only the Israelis had agreed to temporarily halt construction of some illegal settlements in exchange for an extra $3 billion package from the U.S.
First of all, it's a violation of international law. Israel, by doing so, they want to create facts on the ground and to prevent the establishment of the Palestinian state and to separate Jerusalem from the rest of the Palestinian territories. It knows that by doing so, it will prevent the creation of a contiguous Palestinian state.
Just a few months ago, former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Netanyahu never wanted peace with the Palestinians. In the heart of the settlements lies the dehumanization of the Palestinian nation, which allows the Israelis to do whatever they want, no matter how illegal or immoral it might be, from vandalism to settler terrorism. In the past decades, the only encounter between the Israelis and Palestinians has been that of the occupiers who are armed and violent, and the occupied who are despairing and deprived of their basic rights. Therefore, the only way the residents of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank can remind people of their existence is active resistance, confronting the brutality of the occupation through military and non-military action.
problem is that the Israeli deliberate government army violence has been allowed to continue along with settler terrorism, and then you take out a few Palestinian responses and you say condemn those. I would like to see a total condemnation of the violence. We have always condemned violence. We've always said it has to be a nonviolent solution.
Political groups such as Fatah and Hamas have been the building blocks of the resistance against Israel since the late 1950s. Following the Arab failure to stop Israeli aggression against Palestinians, Fatah was established by Yasser Arafat and his friends in 1959 as a national resistance movement. Fatah's retaliatory attacks against Israel helped introduce the Palestinian plight and cause to the international community. But Arafat was later criticized for accepting the failed 1993 Oslo Accords, which politically diminished the resistance while dividing Palestinians. As Fatah's political touch diminished, a new group by the name of Hamas was established in 1987 by Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and other Palestinian figures. Hamas has increasingly become the leading Palestinian force against Israel after its fierce defense of Gaza against Israeli invasions since 2006. Meanwhile, non-military resistance shapes a great bulk of Palestinian resistance. When Israel began construction of the wall within the West Bank in 2002, the Palestinian anti-apartheid wall campaign was formed in reaction, and Palestinian villages in the path of the wall staged regular non-violent demonstrations. Today, popular committees across the West Bank continue to resist Israel's confiscation of land for the wall and settlements through weekly demonstrations. In 2005, over 170 Palestinian organizations joined together calling for the use of boycott, divestment, and sanctions tactics to bring freedom, equality, and justice to Palestinians, which in the end resulted in the global BDS movement. Palestinian and Israeli prisons have repeatedly gone on hunger strike to protest deplorable prison conditions and Israel's use of administrative detention orders, which allow for the arrest and detention of Palestinians without charge or trial.
This kind of detention is based on a secret file that is shared only between the military commander who issues the orders and the military judge, the judge in the military court, with the prosecution. So the lawyer, the prisoner, they won't be able to see this secret file. They don't know the charges. There are no charges. In short, this kind of detention is arbitrary detention. It lacks the minimum fair trial components of a court. And the prisoners simply want to be released.
Despite their aggressive behavior, the Israelis pretend to be seeking peace in the region, mainly to escape the pressures of peace groups at home and abroad. Every now and then, they used to say that if the Arab states simply recognized them as a normal state in the Middle East, they would feel secure enough to reach accommodations with the Palestinians. But since the normalization of ties with a number of Arab states, the Israeli regime has been pursuing its colonial policies as before. The question is, what shall the Palestinians do when diplomacy seems too impotent to ease their plight? IRIB English Radio.